You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 50, Egypt Epilogue with Derek Davison. Thanks for joining me. This episode, we are taking a step back from the narrative and returning to the Middle East. Now that Napoleon has left Egypt, the whole region has become kind of peripheral to our story. Egypt and the Ottoman Empire will probably get no more than a few lines for the whole rest of the show, despite being our setting for 7 episodes. Napoleon left quite abruptly, without so much as a farewell, but I didn't want to leave you guys hanging the way he did with the Army of the Orient. So, before we see Bonaparte ascend to power, I thought we'd use this episode to provide an epilogue to our time in Egypt. I discussed the end of the French expedition in episode 48, but there's still a lot more to say about the long-term consequences of the campaign. The French were not able to realize the dream of a Middle Eastern empire, but their invasion and brief occupation still represents a crucial turning point in the history of the region. To help us unpack the legacy of the Egyptian expedition, I've brought back Derek Davison, an expert on Middle Eastern history who you'll remember from episode 40. Without further ado, here's my interview with Derek Davison.
So, I thought we'd start off talking about Egypt. The British stuck around until 1803, then they left the country to the Ottomans and the Mamluks. Why don't you take us through what happened after that?
Right, so this is the place where Napoleon's impact was probably most readily apparent, because the Mamluks are not long for the world now, having suffered defeat at his hands. After Britain leaves, and they'll be back, by the way, spoiler alert. After Britain leaves, the Ottomans see an opportunity with the power of the Mamluks having been kind of broken by Napoleon to reimpose some imperial control over Egypt. I mean, we talked last time about how they kind of left the administration of Egypt up to the Mamluks, and they'd really lost power. Their governors were virtually captive in Cairo, and the Mamluks were really running the show. So the Ottomans see an opportunity to put themselves back in charge, and they put together an army, a small army, of Albanian recruits, and send it to Egypt to serve as the foot soldiers for a new governor. And they put the new governor in place, but fairly quickly things fall back into the pattern of sort of factional disputes and power struggles. And in this case, it's a three-way thing. It's not just the governor versus the Mamluks. It's the governor versus the Mamluks versus this Albanian army that was supposed to put the governor in power, but then put him in power and kind of stuck around to see what they could get out of being in Egypt. Ultimately, the Mamluks kind of try to play both sides against one another, and it's really the Ottoman governor and his own Turkish or sort of Ottoman soldiers against the officers of this Albanian military unit. But the second in command of the Albanian army, whose name is Muhammad Ali, does an even better job than the Mamluks of sort of manipulating all the players around him, and eventually he emerges not only as the commander of the Albanian force, but ultimately as the governor. He gets appointed in 1805 by the Ottomans, sort of as an acknowledgement of the fact that he was in charge in Egypt and there was really nothing they could do about it. Muhammad Ali had designs on establishing an independent kingdom dynasty that his descendants would rule from that time on. That wound up not happening, but he did establish a hereditary governorship that took Egypt through the rest of its all the way into the 20th century, actually. his main initial goal, Muhammad Ali's main initial goal after he became governor, was to reform the Egyptian military, which is obviously, having just seen the performance of the Egyptian military against Napoleon, you know, you want to rebuild that military along European lines to adopt European weapons, European tactics, all the things that Napoleon's army could do that put the Mamluks at such a disadvantage. Naturally, the Mamluks, who were doing very well for themselves and were resistant to change even after, you know, kind of living through this humiliating defeat by Napoleon, they didn't want any part of this change. They were worried that it was gonna ruin the cushy situation they had for themselves in Egypt, so they resisted. And the dynamic kind of played back and forth. Muhammad Ali was allied with the Mamluks sometimes when he needed them to sort of challenge the governor, and then after he became governor, there were factions within the Mamluk system that one would occasionally be allied with Muhammad Ali, and another might, you know, oppose him, and they would clash with one another. But finally, in 1811, he decided enough was enough. The Ottomans made a request, or order, I guess, since they were still nominally his superiors, that Muhammad Ali put together an army to send to Arabia to deal with the first Saudi state, and which was already kind of developing in Central Arabia and becoming a problem for the empire. Muhammad Ali took advantage of this opportunity, called a big ceremony at the Citadel in Cairo, to announce that he was putting his son Tosun in charge of the army, and it was kind of a send-off ceremony for him. And he invited 74 of the most senior leading Mamluks in the country to attend this dinner, this party, festival. And they did. They went in. They had a nice meal. Everybody clapped everybody's backs, you know, had a good time. And when the Mamluks, at the end of the night, turned to leave, they found the gates of the citadel were closed, and they were left stuck in the courtyard where Muhammad Ali had his soldiers basically massacre them, gun them down in the courtyard of the citadel. That was the event that it's called the massacre at the citadel that broke the power of the Mamluks for good and left Muhammad Ali sort of in sole unquestioned control of Egypt.
Now, I wanted to tease out a little more. You know, you brought up reform, and something I've always found interesting, particularly in these Middle Eastern cases, is when states want to do this type of military reform, they often find that, you know, the European-style army is kind of a package deal with the European-style state. And so that's often an entry point into other types of reforms.
That was certainly the case here. I mean, the first thing that Muhammad Ali did was he opened an officer's academy. So already you're kind of getting into the education system. He sent promising young officers overseas to train with European militaries in European countries. And those officers would then return, naturally having been exposed to the kind of froth of the Enlightenment, I guess, or however you want to put it, and also with training in European languages, which was something that nobody in the Ottoman Empire had really bothered with until this point. They came back with an understanding that, as you say, there's more to it than just kind of training the military and arming it. You have to have training in a whole variety of specialized disciplines. You got to have training in medicine, modern medical techniques. You've got to have training in engineering. You've got to have training in chemistry to manufacture, you know, explosives and other things. You've even got to have training in kind of veterinary science to take care of the horses. So all of these things, you know, they kind of came back with these ideas, and Muhammad Ali began setting up other academies and all these different disciplines to support his military reforms. He set up another academy to train people in European languages, which wound up producing people who could do translation or who could be sent abroad as diplomats. So the education sector in Egypt was profoundly affected by these reforms. He had to do other things. He had to establish a census in order to do an efficient kind of conscription into his new military. He had to finance the new military, which he did through seizing kind of old feudal land grants and imposing taxes on things like religious endowments that had heretofore been untaxed and were, technically speaking, under Islamic law, not supposed to be taxed. That also helped to reduce kind of the power of the old establishment, especially the scholarly community, who might have posed a threat to his rule, but they were, you know, losing revenues, so they were diminished in terms of their ability to be an opposition force. On top of that, he made some reforms in the Egyptian agricultural economy. He started experimenting with things that could be sold overseas and eventually settled on cotton, which became really Egypt's major cash crop, started to try to build up domestic industry. And at first, that was limited to weapons production and textiles that could be sold overseas, but, you know, had an impact in terms of providing jobs and encouraging people to kind of come into the cities where these factories were located. He instituted what was essentially a command economy, where the government was solely, you know, the kind of the sole buyer for these agricultural products and industrial products, and the sole exporter, and that brought in a lot of additional revenue.
So you already mentioned, you know, this not quite dynasty that he founded carried the country all the way up until pretty recent history. So is it safe to say he was pretty successful as a reformer?
Well, he was successful insofar as the European great powers would allow him to be successful. What happened was, I mean, through all of this, up until World War I, technically speaking, Egypt was a part of the Ottoman Empire, and this dynasty that Muhammad Ali founded, which, you know, initially he was the Ottoman governor of Egypt. Eventually, they adopted the title of Khedive, which is a Persian word that kind of means viceroy. It implies a kind of royal status. And then, you know, eventually Egypt became a British protectorate in the 1880s. And then after World War I, when the Ottoman Empire was defunct, the dynasty adopted the title of king, which it held until 1952 when Egypt became a republic. But the reforms that Muhammad Ali made, the problem for the Europeans in the 19th century, as Egypt became stronger and these reforms really took root, was the concern about the condition of the Ottoman Empire, which is something I think we'll talk about in a little bit here. But Muhammad Ali went to war twice with the Ottomans without ever kind of giving up his subordinate status. He was very careful not to make that claim of independence. But nevertheless, he went to war with them once in 1831 to 1833, after which he gained control of Syria. And he went to war with them again in 1839 to 1841. And that was the war that sort of caused Britain in particular to intervene and say, enough is enough, because there was a real concern that Muhammad Ali was either going to establish his independence or he was going to kind of wipe out the entire empire. And the Europeans were very worried about what would happen to the balance of power if the Ottoman Empire broke up or, you know, was kind of absorbed into some other empire. I mean, particularly, you know, Russia was seen as the big threat to kind of move in and take big chunks of the empire and upset the balance of power. At the end of that 1839-1841 war, Britain put its foot down and forced Muhammad Ali to give up his claim to Syria and to make other concessions. What he got in return was a guarantee from the Ottomans, but also from the European powers, that his governorship over Egypt would be a hereditary thing, that the Ottomans wouldn't be able to take it away later on. But among those concessions was Muhammad Ali had to agree to drastically reduce the size of his army. And that affected all of these other reforms, which were made kind of contingent on building a really large, mighty military force. So a lot of that stuff atrophied the academies, and so a big chunk of this reform effort died, kind of withered on the vine. Some of the things that he instituted did remain and are, I think, evidence of his success as a reformer. Egypt developed a very strong bureaucracy in this period, really became kind of a nation state, even though, again, nominally was still part of the Ottoman Empire. And that's that served Egypt, I think, in pretty good stead, really up to the present day. I mean, it was Egypt's transition into the modern world, if you want to think of it that way.
All right, so I think now's as good a time as any to move on to the Ottoman Empire. Now, there were some similar reform processes that were actually already underway when Napoleon arrived.
Right, so the conventional wisdom about this question used to be that Napoleon's arrival in Egypt was this massive wake-up call for the Middle East, and by Middle East, we mean the Ottoman Empire. More recently, historians have discarded that notion, mostly because the timeline doesn't work out. The Ottomans were already undertaking European-style reforms at least a decade before Napoleon showed up. And, you know, obviously, the reason for this is the Ottomans had contacts, regular contacts with Europeans, and more to the point, were regularly kind of losing wars to the Europeans in the 18th century. So they knew something was wrong before Napoleon showed up. They knew that their relationship or their kind of stature vis-a-vis European powers like Russia and the Habsburgs was very much on the wane. You can go all the way back to the late 17th century, really, the Great Turkish War, which was fought the Ottomans against the Holy League, which consisted of the Habsburgs, Russia, Venice, and Poland-Lithuania. The siege of Vienna, which began that war, which the Ottomans lost and had to lift in 1683, is considered sort of the high watermark of the Ottoman Empire because it's their furthest extent, and they would never reach that extent again. The war ended with the Treaty of Karlowitz in 1699, which was the first time the Ottomans had to conclude a treaty with European powers at a disadvantage. Or in other words, the first time they had lost really a major war against the Europeans. They had to give up territory in the Balkans and Central Europe, mostly to the Habsburgs. That was followed about 20 years later by the Treaty of Pasarowitz, which ended another war that the Ottomans lost to the Habsburgs. They had to give up more territory. They fought a couple of wars against the Russians in the first half of the 18th century that were more or less inconclusive. But then the big blow came in the 1768 to 1774 Russian-Ottoman War. This was a massive defeat. The Ottomans were thoroughly wiped out, and they lost Crimea to Russia. Crimea had a very special place in the Ottoman Empire, not just because it sort of controlled the Black Sea, but because the dynasty that ruled Crimea as Ottoman vassals went all the way back, traced its descent all the way back to Genghis Khan. Now, there's some reason to question that, but nevertheless, that's what they claimed. It was the Jurei dynasty. They were sort of the second royal family of the empire. So this was a huge symbolic blow to lose Crimea. And that was really the wake-up call. Selim III is the emperor who starts introducing these reforms. He became emperor in 1789 in the middle of yet another war that the Ottomans were fighting. They were fighting a war against Russia and the Habsburgs at this point. They wound up losing on both fronts. Although on the Habsburg front, it was a little inconclusive because the French Revolution happened during this period, and the Habsburgs are sort of eager to disconnect themselves from this war with the Ottomans so they could go deal with what was happening on their other flank. Nevertheless, I mean, it was clear to Selim III that something needed to change, that reforms were desperately needed. And so he did a lot of the same things that we talked about earlier with Muhammad Ali. He instituted European-style reform to the military. He tried to bring in new weapons, new technology, to institute new tactics. And this required ancillary things like the creation of military academies, sending people to European capitals to sort of learn what they could about what was happening. Selim was interested only in the military aspect of what was happening in Europe. But nevertheless, I mean, the people he sent abroad to kind of learn about the military tactics and learn about what these armies were up to naturally came back with ideas from that were percolating in Europe, and came back with knowledge of European languages, which again is something that the empire had never really bothered with. Selim eventually opened permanent embassies in a number of European capitals, which the Ottomans had never done. There were permanent European embassies in Istanbul, but there were no permanent Ottoman embassies abroad until Selim's time. And this led to a sort of steady flow of information about what's happening in Europe, and not just on the military front, but, more broadly speaking. The problem for Selim, as Muhammad Ali had, his problem with the Mamluks, the problem for Selim was the Janissary Corps. The Janissaries had been the kind of center, the rock on which the Ottoman military was built for centuries. And they had at one time probably been the premier infantry force in Europe. They were made up of freed slaves who were conscripted in what was called the Debshirme from European families in the Balkans. And there were a lot of rules about what the Janissaries were not allowed to do, basically. They weren't allowed to get married while they were in active service. They weren't allowed to own businesses and do kind of ancillary things, anything that would distract them from their duty as soldiers. Unfortunately for the Ottomans, over the centuries, all those restrictions had become relaxed. They weren't enforced anymore. So what you had was a lot of Janissaries who were married, who did own businesses, and were, kind of very happy with their lives, and were not all that focused on going out and fighting for the empire anymore.
They were more of a social class almost at this point, weren't they? I mean,
yes. I mean, it's fair to say that they were, they had established themselves as kind of upper middle class cadre within the empire. They were very suspicious, as the Mamluks were in Egypt, of these military reforms, even though initially, at least, Selim sought to kind of institute these reforms via the Janissaries, to bring these new weapons and train the Janissaries in using them, train the Janissaries in these new tactics. The Janissaries saw this whole process as a way to undermine their status in society, and so they wanted nothing to do with it. Selim responded to this by saying, okay, if you're not gonna take to these reforms and you're not gonna follow along with me, I'll create a new military force. And he created what's called the Nizam-e Jadid, which is the new order, made up of Turkish conscripts. This was the first time that Turks had been prominent in the Ottoman military, probably since the early decades after the founding of the empire. I mean, really, it had been a long time since the Turks of Anatolia had been this involved in the military. This just made the reforms an even bigger threat to the Janissaries, right? It kind of became, kind of fulfilled the prophecy in a sense. It proved them right that, here's this new military force that's obviously intended to supplant us and is a threat to our status, and we've got to do something about that. At the same time, the reforms that Selim made fiscally to sort of pay for this new army, which were similar to the ones Muhammad Ali made in Egypt. He kind of seized control of feudal land grants and brought them back to the state and used their revenue to finance this new army. That alienated the Derebeys, who were this kind of feudal vassal class. And between the two of them, the Derebeys, who had been responsible for sort of producing levies in times of war, and the Janissaries, who were, for all intents and purposes, the standing military, they formed a kind of ad hoc alliance, along with social conservatives who were concerned about how European these reforms were, and they were, in a sense, considered them to be un-Islamic. And these guys all kind of... together, worked together and overthrew Selim in 1806, which ended this first attempt at a European-style reform in the empire. Then, about 15 years later, you have the Greek War of Independence, which is a real kind of another real wake-up call, a major shock to the empire. Greece gains its independence, and that's a huge blow to the Ottomans. In the middle of that war, Mahmud II took power, and in 1826, he did away with the Janissaries in a way not dissimilar to what Muhammad Ali had done with the Mamluks in Egypt. It's called the Auspicious Incident. Mahmud basically called out his own modern-style military with modern weaponry and artillery, and he armed, actually, the people of Istanbul, who by this point were pretty sick of the Janissaries, and they basically marched themselves over to the main Janissary barracks in Istanbul and blew it up. I mean, they reduced it with artillery and killed the Janissaries inside, and that kind of broke the power of the Janissaries from that point forward. Mahmud left a set of detailed instructions for his son and heir, his sons and heirs, there were a couple of them, that became what's known as the Tanzimat Reform, which is a period that lasted from 1839 until the Ottoman Empire adopted a constitution in 1876. And that was, that was a reform period, again, mostly modeled along European lines. That was the one that really took, because in part the Janissaries were no longer a problem. The important thing, I think, for our purposes is to say that none of this stuff really depended on Napoleon's invasion. These things happened because the Ottomans had their own experiences being battered around by the Europeans and came of their own kind of accord to understand that they, or to believe that they needed to make these reforms. Napoleon's invasion was sort of just another case in point, but the Ottomans already had started down this road before he arrived in Egypt.
So I wanted to delve a bit into this question of decline. I'm sure a lot of listeners, and I'm sure you're probably sick of the term, the sick man of Europe, but that's kind of part of the popular understanding of the Ottoman Empire, and not so much something that, like, scholars of the era talk about. So I was wondering if you could delve into that a little bit, that question of decline versus, as we've seen, there was a lot of attempts to reform and bring the empire up to par with the Europeans. So what's that dynamic there?
There's two aspects to the kind of sick man of Europe discourse. The one is that, the sort of European fear, as I said, that the empire was too weak to defend itself and that, was about to be overrun by the Russians and that this would upset the balance of power. And that was probably a legitimate concern. I think without getting into questions of decline or the sort of decadent rot of the empire, which is the other aspect of this. The empire was weakened by the late 18th century and into the 19th century. It was not as strong as it had been, and it was behind Russia and the Habsburgs and you know other European states in terms of its military, in terms of its organization. And it was a fair concern to say, you know, this empire is kind of teetering a little bit, and we have to worry about what that means for this very delicate system that we've crafted to keep the peace in Europe. That said, yeah, I mean, there's sort of a tendency to view the empire in this period as this kind of decadent oriental place where the sultan, you know, kind of sat on a couch and got drunk and people peeled his grapes for him and fanned him with big fans, and he had, you know, women from his harem all around. And that's a very misleading picture. It's one that's probably enhanced by some of the stories and the art, especially that Napoleon's expedition brought back with it, but it's not a fair picture. There were several sultans, as I said, Mahmud II. He was followed by Abdulmajid I. Abdulaziz followed him. These guys were very intensively involved in trying to catch up, trying to reform the empire, and they made huge changes. I mean, this is a period where the empire transitions from a kind of what we would typically think of as an empire to a modern bureaucratic state in many ways. I mean, there is a huge kind of civilian cadre of functionaries that are built up during this period that are, you know, like anything you would see in Europe. So there's a lot of change happening in this period. There's a lot of effort to get things, to get back to the glory days, if you want to think of it that way. It's not a period where the empire was just kind of listing and resting on its laurels. And I think what demonstrates this most effectively, and part of the reason why the sick man of Europe theory, or the, you know, kind of construct has fallen into disfavor, is because if you look at the Ottoman military's performance in World War I, it is a very effective fighting force. I mean, it holds its own on many fronts until eventually kind of just the overwhelming capacity of mostly Britain wears it down in the Middle East, and pressure from Russia in the Caucasus wears it down on that front. But for much of the war, I mean, the Ottomans, you know, more than hold their own with these European powers. So whatever emerges from this period doesn't seem like the kind of state that spent the last 150 years just kind of decaying from within. So yeah, it's a trope that was talked about during this period, I think, for understandable reasons, and then kind of filtered into the academic view of the Ottoman Empire. But it's definitely not the way people, in at least in, you know, the academy, talk about the Ottoman Empire today.
Right. I mean, I always, you know, if they were declining, it was a slow decline, because they did last a century after this period we're talking about. And then when they finally did fall, you know, those are the exact same forces that took down the Habsburgs and the Romanovs. So that wasn't unique.
Right. I think, I mean, there are developments like nationalism, that the development of nationalism in the Balkans and in Greece is something that the empire was not prepared to handle. And, you know, that was a real blow. But I think the other reason that people have an issue, I think, with the putting things in terms of decline and decay, is there's a sense that it obscures what the real dynamic was in this period, which I think was, you know, that Europe was developing at a faster rate. It wasn't that the Ottoman Empire was on the decline necessarily. It was just that Europe was outstripping it And if you talk about it in terms of Ottoman decline, then you raise questions like the infamous Bernard Lewis book whose title is What Went Wrong? Like something wrong happened. There's something wrong with the Muslim world. There was something wrong with the empire. There's something wrong with Islam. And you get into questions of kind of Islam's compatibility with the modern world. And you know, that's just nonsense Orientalist stuff. I mean, to the extent that there was a disparity, I think it was more because of the advances that were being made in Europe, and the Ottomans by the late 18th century and into the 19th century were playing catch up. They were they would get caught up to where the Europeans had been 5 years ago, and the Europeans were 5 years advanced from that. So there was never a point where there was parity again, but I don't think it's because the Ottomans kind of sat on their butts and just enjoyed the fruits of the Orient or whatever.
Well, that actually is a very good segue into the next thing I wanted to talk about, which is that sort of, you already brought up Orientalism, sort of the cultural, intellectual view of that disparity between the East and the West, which in the West, we're talking about basically Orientalism. And then in the East, there were also some responses to that.
Yeah, I mean, Orientalism as a field or Oriental studies was already kind of an active field by this point. But certainly the group, Napoleon had brought the savants with him. He brought this group of scholars with him to ostensibly to do things like start planning for the Suez Canal, which they did, which is one of the great kind of lasting impacts of Napoleon's invasion. But they brought back, a lot of studies of Egypt and, like scientific studies, things like, plant life and animal life. They brought back impressions of Egyptian society. They brought back, most importantly, I think, ideas that filtered into European art and literature. And so this is a period where you see a lot of paintings of, decadent Easterners sitting on their sofas and eating peeled grapes and whatnot, and women, kind of the harem women and this sort of exotic nature of the kind of world of the East, and that definitely, I think, fueled it helped form kind of the lens through which Europeans in general began to view the Middle East and even the Far East, although, that's obviously a different story. It became sort of a part of the way that academics treated the Middle East as a sort of exotic land that you dropped into and jotted a few things down and then went back home and wrote about how strange these people were and isn't it interesting that they do, these certain things. And it fed a kind of us versus them mentality among Europeans, learned Europeans who are kind of attracted by this lifestyle, but also, kind of everyday people who, got this idea that this part of the world was different and strange and maybe even a little bit scary. So there's definitely Napoleon's invasion contributed to that kind of understanding of the region.
And then in the East, what we've discussed already, that this decline concept is problematic, I guess, would be the academic term for it. But there was among Middle Eastern intellectuals an idea of trying to diagnose this and prescribe solutions to it.
This is another place where there's a tendency to ascribe a lot of influence to sort of the ideas that Napoleon brought with him, the French Enlightenment, the French Revolution, things like liberalism, nationalism, republicanism, ideas about freedom and rights and that sort of thing. It's hard to know where to draw the line because certainly some of that filtered out and there was some influence. It had some influence on intellectuals of the 19th century. But there has been, I think, a movement to say, you know, that the influence isn't as great as maybe we once thought it was. It used to be, you know, people would draw sort of a direct line from the Napoleonic invasion to what's known as the Nahda or the Arab Renaissance of the 19th century. But the fact is, you know, there are people in the Arab world like Jamal ad-Din al-Afghani, Muhammad Abduh, who were reformers who diagnosed that something had happened to change the nature of the power dynamic between Europe and sort of Islamic civilization. And they had a lot of different ideas about, you know, that revolved around kind of embracing the true nature of Islam. Muhammad Abduh was probably the first Salafi, although he wasn't a Salafi the way we think of them today. But he argued that, you know, he wrote and argued about Islam's compatibility with rationalism and modernity. And again, some of these ideas probably did filter in from Europe, although, you know, if we can we say that they came from Napoleon, it's more complicated. But these were, you know, very original thinkers who you know, we have to at least assume that a lot of this came to them. I think it does them a disservice to say they were just kind of copying what people had heard from, you know, Napoleon's invasion or what they brought back from Europe. And they, you know, they wrote about the ways that Islam could kind of get back to its roots, or, you know, find a way for the religion and these fancy, you know, new European technologies and things that were coming into the region could coexist with one another and could, you know, be, you know, kind of exist side by side. They're also responding, in a sense, to the reforms that people like Muhammad Ali and Selim III and, you know, the Tanzimat sultans in the Ottoman Empire, all the reforms that those guys were making. And to the extent that those reforms were influenced by things that came out of Europe, I think, you know, secondhand, then it's fair to say that there was some influence. But, you know, to look at the course of intellectual development, especially in the Arab world in the 19th century, I think it's hard to say just where the European influence ends and the sort of you know, their own ideas of these reformers kick in. We know, for example, like, you know, there's this idea that Arab nationalism began with the arrival of the Europeans and bringing the ideas of nationalism to the Middle East. But nationalism, Arab nationalism, wasn't a thing until basically the eve of World War I. And even then, it was only really a response to the rise of Turkish nationalism in Istanbul and sort of the imperial center. So, you know, there's, I think you can make too much of just how influential these European ideals were.
Yeah, I actually, one of my favorite, you know, illustrations of that is there's a guy, Al-Jabarti, who was a Egyptian intellectual who lived during the expedition. And, you know, the French, if you read French accounts, they say, oh, these people had no idea what freedom was or what a republic was. But you read Al-Jabarti and he, you know, the line in his diary is basically like, oh, apparently these people have a republic, kind of like in Plato.
You know, he's, right,
he's
exactly.
Totally comfortable with the concept, totally familiar with it. You know, granted, maybe he wouldn't have been thinking so much about Plato had he not been presented with these people. But, you know, he had his own conception of these ideas, you know, ready at hand when he encountered them.
Right. And I think, I mean, we lose track of the fact that it was, you know, a lot of the works of Plato and Aristotle were only preserved for later European societies by the Arabs. I mean, they, you know, when they kind of conquered parts of the Roman Empire, they encountered these texts and they preserved them, they read them, they translated them. And it's, you know, only, and, you know, Europe, when the empire falls, I mean, the Roman Empire falls, they kind of lose touch with a lot of this stuff. And it eventually comes back through European contacts with the Middle East, and you know, that leads to things like the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. But it's funny. I mean, you sort of I think there's a real kind of amnesia about that aspect. Now there is also the problem that Napoleon's Arabic translators were so bad that they couldn't really communicate very well with the Egyptians. So they probably, you know, there was probably a disconnect there on some level too.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, I think this is some of, this gets to the core of a lot of what gets obscured by Orientalism, is that there is a lot of common heritage there. And, you know, the Ottoman state, different as it was in a lot of ways from European states, and had a lot of the same challenges and a lot of the same kind of groups, or at least similar groups within it, as European states. And they just, you know, they weren't, being on the periphery as they were, they weren't quite as quick on the draw as the other European states in solving some of these problems they had in common.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, the concept, as I, you know, I mean, I mentioned this earlier, but the whole kind of dynamic of Orientalism is there's an us, which is the Europeans who are enlightened and advanced, and then there's a them, which is all of the peoples of the Orient, who are backwards and decadent and you know, kind of don't share our ideals and principles. And it really does obscure, as you say, the fact that there's a common, a huge body of kind of common literature and beliefs and ideas that the Islamic world was just as big a part of developing as Europe was. And you know, it's that takes I think the relationship between Europe and the Islamic world into some places, some bad places that we're still reckoning with today.
Well, I think that's the perfect segue into the last thing I wanted to bring up, which is something, you know, as I was preparing for this, I kind of tended to look for the overarching themes. And one of the things that occurred to me preparing for this interview was just, you know, when you look at kind of the epilogue of Napoleon's expedition, just how many through lines there are from early 19th century Middle Eastern history right up until the modern era. So, you know, like on the, you know, political side, the Khedivate takes us all the way to the 50s. And these intellectual questions we've been talking about still kind of shape the discourse about the Middle East in the West and in the Middle East itself. So I think that's interesting that there's, you know, that there are so many through lines from this 200 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of ways that Napoleon does. I mean, you know, without overstating the impact of the expedition, I mean, there are a lot of things about it that kind of connect to the modern world. I mean, his printing press. I mean, he brought the first printing press to the Arab world. There were printing presses in operation in Istanbul at the time, but there hadn't been any in Egypt or any other part of the Arab world. So that was a huge thing. I mean, that was a major development. Again, you know, I mean, because his Maltese translators didn't know any Arabic, this didn't really do much for Napoleon. But the idea caught on. I mean, the first Arabic printing press was established in Egypt in 1822, kind of the first indigenous Arab printing press that wasn't run out of Istanbul. You know, and that led to improvements in literacy, to the creation of kind of a popular literature. The dissemination of ideas became easier. So that's a major development. And of course, you have the creation of the entire field of Egyptology, or modern Egyptology, at least, and the discoveries that were made during the expedition, especially the Rosetta Stone, which unlocked hieroglyphics for people, for scholars in Europe. I mean, just, you know, there were a number of things about the expedition that had a direct impact on the modern world.
I do particularly like the symmetry of, You know, you got Muhammad Ali's dynasty going all the way to the 1950s. And then who steps in after that? But a guy who looks a lot like Napoleon.
That's right. That's very true. I mean, Gamal Abdel Nasser is a very Napoleonic figure. He comes to power, kind of overthrowing a corrupt, rotten order, a corrupt monarchy, and has big designs on establishing his own empire. Now, Nasser's idea was more that he wanted to merge the various Arab countries into a single thing. He didn't go out and necessarily try to conquer them, although he did, help Republican rebels around the region kind of go after their monarchies. But nevertheless, I mean, the vision that he had is very similar to the one that I think Napoleon had.
I really enjoyed on your show going through those episodes on Nasser, because I just felt like there's so many echoes. You know, people ask me, that's a question I get a lot from listeners, you know, who's a good modern figure who resembles Napoleon? And I always point to Nasser and Fidel Castro, actually, I think, is also a kind of a Napoleon type figure.
I think the comparison with Nasser is very good, even up to kind of the end. I mean, whatever dream Nasser had of building this pan-Arab state or pan-Arab empire died with him, and it's similar to Napoleon. I mean, it ended with his whole project ended with his death. So I do think there are a lot of parallels there.
So that, I think, takes us naturally into, would you like to talk a little bit about what is going on in Derek world these days? You've got a new project.
Yeah, I think last time we talked, I was still blogging on WordPress, but I've switched over to Substack. I've got a new newsletter where I also do my podcast and other pieces. It's called Foreign Exchanges, and the address is fx.substack.com. You can subscribe. You can sign up for the free email list, or you can subscribe for $5 a month or $50 for a full year if you commit to that up front. It'd be great to have people stop by and check it out.
Well, I really enjoy it. I've plugged your stuff before, and it's a pleasure to do it because I think it is a good recommendation. And anyone who enjoys this, I think, would get a kick out of what you do as well.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on. Anything else you want to add before we cut off here?
I just would like to say I've enjoyed these two episodes, and I'm a big Age of Napoleon fan, and you're doing great work. And thanks for having me on, and good luck with the rest of the project.
Well, I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. The Middle East is a fascinating place, but mostly outside the scope of this show. If you want more Middle Eastern history, and to hear more from Derek, you can find him at fx.substack.com. I'll put a link to it in the description of this episode. Next time, we'll return to Napoleon's story for one of the most momentous events of his life, the coup of Brumaire. Until then, thanks for listening.